My name is Natasha Fernandez Silver, and I think Sean and I today, we want to talk about how we've been organizing around the concept of a Green New Deal in Detroit, and how we have tried to do that organizing at the intersection of the environmental justice movement and the radical labor movement, such as it exists today. A lot of the work that we're doing has been influenced by just the sudden explosion in interest and membership in our chapter. So we went from having like 30 people to 500 people to 1,000 people very rapidly. And we started wanting to have more of a public presence and sort of like assert ourselves in the Metro Detroit area. But we didn't want to do it in a way that would be like stepping on anybody's toes or entering spaces where people are already organizing. So we wanted to be respectful. So we were looking for places to organize where like there was sort of nothing going on yet, or there was some kind of a gap. And that presented itself in Thanksgiving of last year, because unfortunately GM announced that it was going to be closing 5 additional manufacturing plants in North America. There was going to be mass layoffs, like 15,000 people were going to be fired. And as soon as those announcements were made, we got the usual sort of like lame Democratic response. Like, I think Rep. Joe Kennedy was like, "We deserve like better capitalism. We deserve a moral capitalism." Elon Musk, he offered to buy the plant. And it was incredible because like people in Detroit were like, "Oh, I heard Elon Musk, like he's gonna buy the plant, like cool." And we're like, "No, not cool." So we had chapter members, and Sean was one of them, and he's gonna speak to this, but we had a bunch of chapter members who were being directly affected, like in addition to the 15,000 salaried workers who were gonna be affected. Countless temps were fired. So a bunch of people in our chapter who were engineers, programmers, et cetera, were informed that they had already been fired. Like they were just notified of their firing, basically. So we wanted to do something, if for no other reason to show solidarity with the members of our chapter who are gonna be directly affected. One of the plants that was on the chopping block was it's on the border of Detroit and Hamtramck. Hamtramck's, it's like a city within a city. It's completely surrounded by the city of Detroit. And that plant had a very particular history, because that plant was, the land that plant is on was initially taken via eminent domain, like acres and acres and acres, bulldozed to the ground, so thousands of people's homes were just bulldozed, businesses gone, and then the land was gifted to GM with the promise of, "Oh, we're gonna make all these jobs." So this is like in the 80s. Fast forward to 2018, they're done, they're gonna close the plant. But Sean is gonna talk a little bit more about the history of the plant.
Yeah, for sure. So Detroit Hamtramck Assembly was actually built in 1985 on the former Dodge main plant. Some of y'all might be familiar with, if you're at all familiar with like radical auto worker history, Dodge main was famous for being the location of the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement and the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which was a real progressive, black liberation Marxist organization. So that is the place where Detroit Hamtramck was built. Y'all might be familiar as well with a gentleman by the name of General Baker. He was also a founder of that movement. If you're not familiar with it, it's an awesome history. Please look it up. The eminent domain law was actually changed to allow them to, because usually it's just private to public hands when you use eminent domain. This was a specific example where they used eminent domain to go from private hands to private hands for profit, right? Under the auspices of using that to benefit the community and to provide jobs, They thought, you know, they were saying, oh, there's going to be 5,000 permanent jobs in this community. But we see how long that lasted. And this is something that, I mean, for myself, I used to work in the back of the plant in the body shop. And every day when I left work, you would see this hulking ruin of a plant called the Packard plant that used to be, you know, back in the 50s, a luxury car manufacturing plant. And it's there. It's just an empty building. It was almost like a metaphor, like a reminder of what could happen. And it happened within the first 3 years of me being at that plant, right? And like Natasha said, many, many people had their homes demolished. It was actually 4,200 people, mostly immigrant, Polish immigrants, had their homes demolished in order to make way for this plant. And, you know, their sacrifice was basically in vain. The only part of the city of that former Pole Town neighborhood that still stands today is a Jewish cemetery called Beth Olam. And you have to access it through General Motors property. You can only get there twice a year. And future is really in question right now. We have no idea what's going to happen to it when the plant closes. How is that family going to be able to access that that cemetery? It's a big mess. I have a lot of, if you don't mind, I'll go into a little bit more about my personal history and how I ended up at DHAM. I'm from Flint, Michigan originally. I came from a real strong union family. For those of you who are not familiar with UAW history, my grandmother and great aunt, who took a large part in raising me, were both members of the Women's Emergency Brigade. And the Women's Emergency Brigade was an extremely important and integral part of how the UAW was able to exist and come to fruition in the first place. If it wasn't for the sacrifice of those brave women who put their lives on the line and stood between the company police and thugs and the men who were occupying the plant on the inside, the American labor movement never would have been born. And so those are the women who raised me and taught me how to be a socialist, right? And that's my history and that's my background. I love them to death, I swear. But I was in Flint during the time of the Flint water crisis, and I saw that really nothing was getting better. I was sick of seeing brown water coming out of my tap. And sick of worrying about being poisoned every day. And because of the 2015 agreement, allowed two-tier. Who here is familiar with the two-tier situation at General Motors and the UAW? So a good chunk of you. So I was just able to get my transfer rights. So just a quick little bit of background for those of y'all who are not familiar with it. When General Motors went into bankruptcy in 2007, what they did in order to kind of justify keeping manufacturing facilities here, and they did this all over the big three, is they said, all right, we'll keep these plants here, but everyone hired after the 2007 agreement is coming in at half the wage with half the benefits, right? And so for me specifically, at the plant that I was at, Lake Orion Assembly, what that meant for me, because it was a small car plant, and in order to keep the cars profitable, they came up with what was called the 60-40 agreement. 60% would be traditional tier one, what you think of as, you know, a well-paid auto worker, and 40% would be tier two, folks like myself who came in at $15 an hour with no pension and have the benefits. And we were, you know, a lot of times people will say, oh, well, you're doing the same job for unequal pay, but it was even worse than that because we were lower seniority, we were actually doing harder jobs, jobs that were more difficult on our bodies that'll give you arthritis in your, you know, mid to late 20s, which I can personally attest to, for half the wage, right? And so this was the promise of the labor, this was not the promise of the labor movement that our forefathers and mothers fought for, you know? So basically what happened was I would see this tension, this anger amongst the workers in the plant, right? And we have such a strong tradition, and it always bothered me. How do we kind of like meld the traditions of the traditional working class CIO unions with what's going on nowadays, right? And the UAW has a strong tradition of like wearing similar colored t-shirts on certain days to indicate things. So like in the past, when you were doing things like you were in a negotiation with management, the lead negotiator would come out of negotiations wearing a certain color shirt to indicate how well the negotiations were going. And then because of that, the workers would realize, oh, okay, I know I have to act out because they're wearing a red shirt today, and so we're going to have a wildcat, or we're going to have a slowdown, right, to put more pressure on management. Now, the UAW kept that tradition on. They still do these kind of things, but it became meaningless and hollow, right? So at the time, it was during, it was when the Wisconsin public sector unions were being attacked, and the UAW was promoting wearing red on Wednesdays, Solidarity Wednesdays, to support someone in another state, which is great. But for a lot of the folks on the shop floor, it didn't seem relevant. They didn't make the connection. So I thought to myself, hey, how can I make this relevant to myself and my coworkers? So I started thinking about slogans, and I came up with this one, this shirt that says, "No More Tears." And so we could all wear it together on Wednesday to show, hey, we're for equality for all workers, for all auto workers, and it really caught on because of the ratio of Tier 2 to Tier 1 auto workers. So in any event, I worked there for a while. That was a really successful campaign. I'm really proud of it, but I ended up having to leave because they cut my second shift. And so I made my way down to Dehem, and I was there for 3 years, and it didn't last. I ended up having to go back to Flint again, where the water is poisonous and the industrial disinvestment is rampant.
So, you know, Sean's describing the state of the UAW, and basically, this announcement comes down, all these people are going to get fired. And the UAW is nowhere to be found. There's no public response from the UAW. Nobody else really knows how to organize around this because that's the role of the union, right? So we just decided we wanted to try to do something. Sean is in our chapter. We had other people that were also, even if they weren't in the UAW, that worked for GM and they were going to get fired. So we started meeting. There's a great documentary film called Pole Town Lives, and it tells the story that Sean kind of summarized for you all about this plant, how eminent domain was used in this completely backwards way to take homes and land from private individuals to give to a private company to make profit. And we did a public screening, and I don't know if, for those who don't know, Rashida Tlaib, the representative in Congress, is in our chapter. And she's a great, class conflict politician. And so she immediately realized, like, this was an important issue that she needed to be vocal on. So she came to our public screening of this documentary. And at this point in time, our chapter had never done anything in public, like literally, like we would just meet, talk about Jacobin articles or whatever. And like 400 people came, and people were just completely furious because, you know, it's Detroit. GM received like a $50 billion bailout. To add insult to injury, the plant that Sean used to work at and that's subsequently been closed was making the Volt, which was their electric car, which they promised to make as part of the bailout. Not profitable enough, so they were going to scrap that and just focus on pickup trucks. But they're committed to a zero emission future, so that's great. There is just a ton of just electric fury energy around this issue. And so we decided to keep organizing around it. But it was a little tricky, like what was the ask gonna be? Because we didn't wanna just say, like, beg GM to keep these plants open. It's like, we've been doing that. That's how they had the plant in the first place. They just continually hold the people of Detroit over a barrel, saying, if you don't just give us everything, we're gonna leave, we'll take the jobs. And it's like this cycle is just perpetuated to the point of absurdity, right? And on top of that, you know, that's a demand that the UAW should be making as part of its contract negotiations. So we wanted to make a demand that wasn't only about the contract, the plants, et cetera. We wanted to make one that was more about the community and what GM owed the community. We got together. It was really like a mishmash of people. Like, we got in the room, it was like a bunch of workers, like retired UAW members, like environmentalists, like people who'd never organized together. And we started sort of saying, maybe this could be like a Green New Deal thing, because I don't think the Pelosi sit-in thing had happened yet, or maybe it had just happened, because of this like Volt angle where they were stopping production of this like electric car. We wanted to kind of make it about like the Green New Deal, and we didn't quite know. And so the idea started percolating. If you're gonna close the plant, you know what? We're gonna use eminent domain in the way it's intended to address the public good and public emergencies. And we're gonna seize the plant, take it back from General Motors, and put it to public green use, making green automobiles, light rail cars, etc. And obviously, because the plant had been taken via eminent domain in the first place, like there wasn't a really good counter-argument there. So people were like, that's really radical. But nobody else had a really good ask. So DSA started like pushing this like extremely radical idea. But like I said, it was so radical how the plan existed in the first place that nobody really had a sort of counter argument, right? Because what we get a lot in Detroit is the idea of like community benefits. Like, okay, we'll give Ford like 400 acres and like all these tax breaks, and then they'll give us a community benefit of like a $10 million bike rack. So we're like, we want to own the plant. Like the workers own it. So the environmentalists were a little bit like, that's really radical. And then the like older labor folks were like, we would just want the plants to stay open. We just want jobs. They were kind of like, oh, I don't know about this green thing. And then Sean actually came up with the winning slogan that brought everyone together.
Make Detroit the engine of the Green New Deal.
Yeah. So that was the old school new Green New Deal. Like it kind of really brought it home. Like, yes, it is about jobs. It's about manufacturing jobs. It's about like good, you know, union jobs, but it's also about a world we want to live in that's sustainable. And it's a message that will be appealing to auto workers and also students and, you know, service for everybody, right?
And I have to interject and give you an amen. Like, I was so impressed with the amount of, like, coalition building that happened. Like Natasha said, you know, people who had never worked together before in all different parts of the community, all different parts of activist organizations came together over this one issue, because everyone has seen, not only through the environment, through people who have lived through poverty, people who have been screwed over in their neighborhoods for so long. I mean, the entirety of Southeast Michigan is really a testament to the failures of capitalism to support workers and humanity in the ecosystems. I mean, it's just obvious, it's there. All you gotta do is go through Flint, Saginaw, Pontiac, Detroit. I mean, it is a living testament to how capitalism has failed us. And people see that instinctually, and it allowed us to come together in such a powerful way that I had never experienced before. I mean, the DSA itself was so dynamic, but when we started getting more people in different groups, like the pro, I wish y'all could see these pictures, because Natasha came up with this great slideshow, and it just, the protest was dope. I mean, it was like the best protest I'd ever been to.
So we came up with this set of demands, which was just like so far beyond what anyone had ever felt comfortable sort of demanding or advocating for. But like, we had Rashida Tlaib like sign on immediately. And so that kind of just set the bar. So then we had like city council people and Abdul El Sayed, the guy who ran for governor. So we had like this really high profile list of people that were like, yes, let's completely like take over, like nationalize GM, like whatever, right? So we then planned this rally. Every year in Detroit, they do the auto show. Do you guys, have anybody been to the auto show? Yeah, so one of the days of the auto show is the auto show prom. And it's basically the auto show executives come all dressed up in like tuxedos and ball gowns and just like celebrate themselves. So we just like descend on them. It's like we get all these people from, in the background, right? UAW is like not really appreciating this. They're like, why are you guys talking about this? So
they had no response, like no public protest, no demonstrations. They weren't seeking any kind of input from workers, right? And it wasn't until we were like headlong into this organizing campaign and getting this protest ready that they finally, at the last minute, called a candlelight vigil.
Literally, like
we're mourning for the death of something. We're not fighting for anything anymore.
No, they literally, like, they were doing, so they basically held a counteraction to our thing, which was bizarre, but so we were like, okay, we support the UAW, so we had all of our people go to their vigil with the candles and stuff, and the hilarious thing was, so Rashida was there for the protest, and we, you know, she had all the talking points, and she's, like, ready to go on, like, our message, right? And then they start doing, like, a Christian prayer, like, and she was like, the heck? So she just leaves. So we're like chasing Rashida basically because she's like got the bullhorn, and she's just like, if you leave, I want every cent we gave you back. Like, if you leave, like, we're taking back the plant, right? So we just, I mean, we just went with it, and it was like a really great, like, class-based rally, because I mean, literally, like, people in ball gowns and tuxedos were, like, running away from Rashida. Like, they don't like to walk from where they park their cars, so they get, like, seriously, they get golf carts to, like, ship them into the thing. I mean, it's surreal. It's Detroit. It's, like, this, like, I mean, there's blight everywhere, and these, like, people in tuxedos are getting, like, driven around in a golf cart to this, like, gala, right? And at one point, one of the golf cart, the wheels blew out, and Rashida's like, serves you right!
Yeah, we had some, our friend over here, Ethan, actually headed up our little band. We had a protest band going on, and I mean, it was just dope. I mean, I just loved it so much. We had, like, the Detroit Light Brigade came out with a bunch of light-up signs, you know what I mean, talking about the Green New Deal. I mean, it was fantastic.
Yeah, and like we taught everyone in Detroit which side are you on, which like they hadn't heard ever. Like, I mean, literally, like, that's what our band was playing, and so it was cool because there were so many people that were catalyzed around a Green New Deal, but like in a sort of apolitical way, or like not appreciating that this is a class conflict. Like, we're not going to get the Green New Deal, you know, as we want it unless we have like complete like class warfare around this. Otherwise, it's just going to be green capitalism. It's just going to benefit capitalists, you know, who already caused the problem in the first place, right? So our slogans were like, seize the plant, save the planet. GM is ours. Detroit is our city, not GM's, which was one of the signs that was used for the protests in the 80s when the plant was taken by our people's houses were lost by eminent domain, green union jobs now. And so we basically like got every single like social justice community group, environmental group, and like a ton of rank and file people on board for this action. And we got some radical communist trade unionist from Brazil to come.
Oh, yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, all the way from Sao Paulo. I mean, General Motors workers from Sao Paulo, Brazil, that came because of a radical organization called Auto Worker Caravan, who's been organizing with the UAW for many years, and they got them to come up, and it was just, it was great to see that level of international solidarity. Also, it's worth mentioning that one of the plants that was closing, as well as Detroit Hamtramck Assembly, was the plant in Oshawa, Ontario, Canada, and I had been in contact with some of our union brothers and sisters up there, and they sent two busloads of folks down to support us in our protest and show solidarity. So it was truly an international protest and action. It was very inspiring.
And now their main thing is like calling for the Oshawa plant to be nationalized in Canada.
Yeah, and they're actively working that with the New Democratic Party. They've got many of their politicians in Ontario to sign on to it. It's actually, I mean, there's a lot of momentum going towards it, and I've been trying to get on the UAW about doing that here, and I've yet to receive an adequate response.
So we have this really great action. It really helped us solidify our relationship with Rashida Tlaib and all these other groups in the area. The Sunrise Movement. I mean, at that time, Sunrise didn't even actually have anything in Michigan. So So we basically like helped Sunrise get going, organizing in the area. And Ethan, who's here, and Sean made a bunch of really great videos, which we wanted to show you, but we have no capacity to do so. But like, you should check out like the Detroit DSA Facebook page, so you can see the really amazing video work they did. The first video they did was sort of generally about the plant closings, and the second one was about the Green New Deal, but it's about the Green New Deal from a labor perspective, not from the perspective of like a college kid. And maybe you can talk about it a little more, how you were thinking about it.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, General Motors does things like this in contract years or close to contracts because they want to kind of like set the tone for the negotiations, and they've just been through their most profitable years ever, right? I mean, they've made money hand over fist, not only you know, off of our labor, but workers all over the world, right? And it is really truly time for us to share in the wealth that we've created for GM. And so, you know, the first video, I think, Ethan, if you want to articulate on it, I welcome you to as well. But I mean, for me, it's just about getting folks to understand that this is truly a class conflict. This is not just something that, you know, that just happens randomly. They're playing chess out here, and we're out here playing checkers. We got to think a little bit further ahead than what we've been, right? So it's to understand that they're trying to put us in a situation where we're begging for our jobs instead of looking to get our pensions back or to get full wages back or to hire the temporary workers back, right? Because it's more than just two-tier now. We have exploitation of temporary workers. We have exploitation of third-party contract workers in the plants that do jobs that were traditionally done by tier one employees. And they're using this to leverage advantage over us and to exploit us more and to get more of our surplus value. We got to start thinking a little further ahead, right? And as far as the Green New Deal is concerned that Ethan and I made, the whole concept behind it was basically like, look, we've done this before. We did it during the Great Depression. We have seen economic decline and collapse happen, and it's been happening in our industrial heartland since the 80s. You know, it's been happening my entire lifetime that, you know, Detroit and Flint have been, you know, basically obliterated. And so we cannot just like look at this from a distant perspective. You have to look at it from a perspective on the ground. We have to try to fight back now. Now is the time. This is not distant for people, my friends and family back in Flint, Michigan. You know, this is a reality, a lived reality. And so it calls for just as strong of a response today as we had back in the 1930s, right? That's why we need things like an economic bill of rights. That's why we need things like a Green New Deal. So we can, because we have this huge industrial capacity. I don't think people understand and truly realize what we're capable of doing as a society, right? Like I was talking with my wife last night, looking at the skyline of Chicago, and you look at the skyline of Chicago, and that was all built by working class people. That was built by people like you and me, and we can do that again, and we can do it better. And imagine how much better it could be if we did it for the public good and not just for the private profit of a few. It's a matter of. It's a matter of the organizing principles we want to base our society around. What do we truly value? Do we value one another? Do we value our future together? Do we value leaving a healthy planet to our children? Do we value the things that make us, you know, self-actualize? Or are we just valuing the things that make short-term quarterly profits for the CEOs of these big fucking companies that don't give a shit about us? And let me tell you, every day of my life when I was living in Flint and walking around the town being poor as hell, I always wondered, why is it? Why is it that our society has to be this way when we used to be the richest, wealthiest city and area in the entire planet per capita because of the labor movement, now whittled down to nothing? Because we've lost class consciousness. Ever since the McCarthy era, ever since the Red Scare, they've beat it out of us. But now because of the Bernie Sanders campaign and because of you all out there doing your work in your local community, we have the opportunity to bring socialism back to the forefront and do positive things, because this is not just a fantasy. This has been the reality of the history of our country. It's because of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. It's because of the CIO. It's because of the UAW. It's because of the New Deal that allowed us to live the quality of life that we have today. And if we don't start reinvigorating that and proposing radical ideas like the Green New Deal, we will never have that again. We'll have a lower quality of life.
Message we need for the Green New Deal. So, like, I mean, I think that's well, that was our immediate next step after we did this rally. We want to push the conversation on the Green New Deal. Like, socialists need to be pushing the conversation on the Green New Deal, because if we don't, capitalists have a lot of money, and like Sean said, they're playing chess out here, right? Like, they, I'm sure, have a great plan for like co-opting whatever the heck the Green New Deal is going to mean. So we need to be out in front, and we need to be pushing forward our vision of how we want it to be. So after the rally, Rashida was like, can you guys give me some ideas like for a Green New Deal? So we basically got together, and we were like, well, let's look at the first New Deal. And we kind of decided that we wanted to propose a regional agency. So I'm gonna say like the TVA, but I don't want anyone to be triggered by like visions of dams or anything. Like, not what the TVA does, but just a regional planning agency that would be funded by the federal government, and it would pay for like all these works projects that we need. So we have a horrific infrastructure in Michigan. Like, our water infrastructure is probably the worst in the whole nation. That's what happened. That's why the Flint water is so bad. In Detroit, we constantly have water boiling advisories and stuff. So we have a housing crisis. We need to weatherize our houses. I mean, there's just so much that needs to be done that is like low-hanging fruit, right? Like, it's things that are part of a green revolution but are not complicated. Like, anyone in the Midwest would appreciate the need for that and understand that it can be done. It has been done before. We would just need the political will and public investment in doing so. So the idea was to call it the Great Lakes Authority, and it would cover the Rust Belt, because the Rust Belt and the Great Lakes Basin basically overlap with each other. You basically just tack on Minnesota. And they would focus on green manufacturing, green housing, build 1.2 million new zero carbon housing units, which are just desperately needed in Detroit. Like, the housing crisis is just unbelievable. It would protect the lakes, right? So just like describing the Green New Deal in a way that makes sense to people, because I just don't think a lot of people can really, they just can't conceptualize like decarbonization. Like, it's a very sort of abstract way to talk about climate change. So we wanted to focus on the built environment and on the lakes, like things that people already really, really care about. And so we've been sort of using, I mean, not to say like this is the only way that the Green New Deal could play out, but we want to be describing it in ways that make sense to people. Like, they would be a part of government that would do it. They would take federal resources and pay for these projects that we need. They would hire you to go and build this stuff. And so we've been doing like Green New Deal canvases, where we basically describe the Green New Deal in these terms. And we talk about, these would be prevailing wage jobs, like these would be great for unions. And we're now working on a new video with Ethan, where we are getting union members and workers of all different stripes to talk about the Green New Deal in like these very kind of concrete ways. And I think like this is, to me, this is like our challenge right now, is to take over the conversation on the Green New Deal and push a real like concrete proposal. And obviously, like, we've pushed this with Rashida's team and whoever else is willing to listen. But it's just it's a starting point. It's a conversation, because I think we can't like hide behind the TVA was bad, so we'll just never do anything again. I think we need to start proposing ideas for how the Green New Deal would play out and debating them and moving forward. Right? If we are just in a constant negative stance, we're gonna lose this to the capitalists. We've got to push forward a red Green New Deal.
I think one of the beautiful things about the idea of the Great Lakes Authority is that it's, I think things that are local are more achievable and they're inherently more democratic. They also allow you to experience less burnout because they're more achievable. And if you're like me and you've been doing this activist thing for many years, burnout is a real issue. You know, I like seeing successful actions. I want to see things happen in my local community or even just on the state level. But wherever it's achievable and we can get traction and we can move things forward. And as far as having conversations with, you know, working class folks, I have a few ideas. You know, I'm an auto worker. I'm not a professional speaker. You know, I deliver parts all day in a body shop, you know, at a factory. You know what I mean? And for me, like the number one thing really, and this has gotten me through a lot of political conversations with people I don't necessarily agree with, is that you have to develop a rapport that is external to politics. You know, find some kind of common ground, some common hobby, some common interest. So no matter how vehemently you disagree with one another, you can always go back to a base of friendship and solidarity, right? And that goes for not only people you work with, but people in your family as well. I think another really awesome way to contextualize it is that it is a jobs bill, right? It is for the working class, it is for workers, and it is for, you know, we're for a prevailing wage. It's not just, we're gonna give you 12 bucks an hour. It's, we want you to have enough money to where you and your family and your loved ones can live comfortably, right? You have to know your audience sometimes, right? So I know for me, like sometimes if I don't say socialism, I'll say things like economic democracy because everybody loves democracy, right? But it still gets across, but it still gets across the exact same message, right? And so for folks who already have a really strong preconceived notion about what socialism is and would otherwise not listen to you, that might open them up a little bit, right? And quite frankly, climate, it should not be about partisanship. It should be about survival, because that's what we're talking about, the survival of our planet, the survival of our species. And there's a lot of cognitive dissonance that's involved with it as well. Like for folks who work at my factory who build heavy-duty trucks, these are huge trucks, and they're hugely profitable trucks for the company, and they get good overtime for these things. So in order for them to bridge that gap, they really need to see and identify this not as like a foo-foo academic thing, but a real bread and butter thing that will get them jobs and support their family and support their communities. And lastly, I think that for me personally, building the Chevrolet Volt as opposed to building the heavy-duty trucks that I build now, when you're doing something that you know is positive for humanity and positive for the environment, it's a way to fight alienation, right? Because what a horrible feeling it is to go to work every day and know that you're doing something that's horrible for the environment and horrible for your long-term survival, right? So wouldn't we all like to have meaningful work where we're contributing to the betterment of mankind? I mean, how hard is that? I think there needs to be a lot of legislative provisions that will help workers, right? Like apprenticeships. I mean, I don't know about y'all, like I went to college and I didn't get shit from it, other than a bunch of debt. You know what I mean? Really, it was almost like a waste of time. College is like a business. You know, you look at places like Germany, they have awesome apprenticeship programs. Why can't we take what works in other countries and use that in our own country? Right? And because these jobs, these are highly skilled jobs. I work with contractors in the plant that help set up our robots that when they're not working in the auto plants, they're setting up wind turbines hundreds of feet above the ground. I mean, these are highly skilled, highly paid jobs, and there's no reason that we cannot have a massive apprenticeship program here in this country to prepare us to make the Green New Deal a reality. Obviously, we need the right to organize. We need to have worker safety. Public ownership of these private companies. I mean, I don't know if y'all saw, but Bernie he proposed something recently that blew my mind, right? What was the headline? An appeal to moderates. Bernie advocates public ownership of private institutions or private companies, something like that. I mean, why can't we do that? Every hour you work, you get a certain percentage of stocks in this company, eventually gradually going over to worker ownership. That would be a beautiful thing, and we can achieve that. The proposals and policies are out there. So I have a couple more things to add, but I didn't know if you had anything else.
You know, we want to have time for, because we want to get everybody's ideas, because, I mean, we certainly don't know how to achieve the Green New Deal and have it be, you know, in support of worker ownership, right? So we want to hear what other people are organizing around, ideas you have on, you know, reactions to anything we've said. So I'm okay wrapping it up, opening the floor.
Yeah, what do y'all think?